I use the title Ladies and Gentlemen advisedly, especially in tonight's shiur, which focuses on ladies and gentlemen. There's a recent popular book which is entitled Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. I have the book in my house. I've read through most of it. I recommend it. It's a good book. It comes from a completely secular perspective. But we are told that Chochma Bagoyim Tamin, there is wisdom amongst the nations as well. Our Torah provides additional insights and wisdoms. And the once again, we give great credit to Rabbi Feldman, the author of this wonderful book. For those who don't have it, buy it. Called The River, The Kettle, and The Bird. Rabbi Feldman now serves at the Rosh Hashiva in Ner Yisrael in Baltimore. These are shirim he gave in Eretz Yisrael when he was there for quite a few years to B'nai Yeshiva. It's written for men, although I'm told that more women read this book than men. That's itself interesting, but perhaps because they are more concerned with what we call relationships. He has two chapters, chapter 5 and chapter 6. 5, as you see in front of you, is recognizing the female nature. 6 is entitled More on the Female Nature. So obviously this is something very important for men to understand. Women understand it already. And my role this evening is to explain to the men what the women know already, and in the presence of the women, so that no man can later deny it. That's what this is all about. But of course I'm very happy to take questions from both men and women who wish to comment on what we're discussing. So the underlying assumption over here is that men and women are not just different in their anatomy, which everyone agrees, but are different in the way they are, we'll call, wired. They just think differently. They conduct them. Their life is different. They're different types of individuals. And therefore, to assume, as some modernists do, that men and women are identical, say, for the anatomy, for the very basic anatomy, is simply misguided. It's wrong. It's not true. And if this is against some orthodoxy of today called feminism, what have you, so it's too bad. I'm just saying what I consider to be the truth, based on both the words of Chazal and, as I said before, even non-Jewish scholars who are looking at it honestly, have come to the same exact conclusion. Okay, so Rabbi Feldman begins by telling us that in order for a husband to live in peace with his wife, he has to recognize and appreciate her female nature. Now, today's topic is not limited to married couples. This is important for women to understand a man and vice versa in all contexts. But of course, the most important context is the marriage context. They're given different roles in life, especially the family unit. It's very important. They're different emotions, different intellectual systems. And if men would understand women better, a lot of the friction could be eliminated. Fine. So the first point he has over here is something he quotes from a great Talmidei Chachamim. He refers to the top of the next page, 47, two of the great sages of our time. He's referring to two brothers-in-law, the Chazon Ish and his brother-in-law, the Stipler. Each one of them wrote a letter, which was subsequently published, about Shalom Bayis. Those who want to see the letters in their entirety are encouraged to find one of two handbooks, you might call them, Hadrocha LeChasanim, which were published by two great giants of Musar of the last generation, Rav Shlomo Valbi, who published one, and Rav Chaim Friedlander, Panevich Yeshiva, who published another one. They're both great, and they both have these letters of the Chazon Ish and the Stipler, and my Talmidim know these letters well, because we go over them, and it's very, very important to understand how there has to be, and these are, you know, how should I say it nicely, Litvaks, and then that's just their, the way they grew up, and then what we call Lithuanian Yeshivas, which are known to be intellectual, and almost, there's an expression in Yiddish, I'm just saying it, called a kalta litvak. You heard that expression? It means someone who's cold and rational, and it's not so much of the warm type, but they say, no, marriage must exude warmth. Marriage cannot have formality, the Chazon Ish writes. You can't have a formal relationship with a husband and wife. That's ridiculous. That's just the opposite of what marriage is supposed to be. This is coming from giants of Torah, who are also giants in dealing with people, dealing with problems. You know, some gedolim, they were primarily in the study hall, and they didn't deal that much with people and their daily problems. These were not that way, these gedolim. All the world's problems, medical problems, family problems, came to them, and they dealt with it on a very wonderful basis, that were renowned throughout the world. So they explain that a woman very much wants to be loved, admired, and respected. That's true. It's true of men too. Look, we have a lot of men in the room. We all know we also like to be loved, admired, and respected. Why not? But for a woman, apparently it's more critical than for a man. And quoting on this page, he quotes from these two gedolim, that a woman's nature is to find favor in her husband's eyes, and that giving the woman the feeling she's unloved is akin to spilling her blood. Whoa, they write in Hebrew, shvichas damim, spilling blood. Again, this is not a license for a woman to tell a man, you know, you're no good, and you're unloved, and I don't like you. That's not right, and it shouldn't be said. But if the man is told that, somehow will be able to get over it a little more easily than a woman. Here's the next most critical of all paragraphs. This is why the sages say that a woman desires to be married more than a man does, and as a result is not as particular as a man in choosing a mate. A woman's attitude in choosing a mate, the sages say, is tav lemesav tandem lemesav armalum. It is better to live as a twosome than to live like a widow. Now, it's a little history over here. It's very important. Some 35 years ago, I believe, a particular rabbi said that this no longer applies. It doesn't apply anymore. This Talmudic expression, which is quoted from the Talmud, was only meant in a circumstance when women, if they were not married, would starve to death. Because in those days, women couldn't earn a livelihood. So a woman has to have a husband to provide for her. So if the husband's not so great, look, brings back some people call it the bacon, we'll call it the chicken, I don't know what to call it. He brings back the bread, he makes a living. So she needs the husband, but he, who can make a living by himself, doesn't need a husband's a wife so much. So this rabbi said, today the women are able to earn their own livelihoods, so it's not so important for them to be married. Hence this Talmudic expression, with all that it entails, no longer applies. My Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, Zichron Levrach, was very upset by this. And in a shiur he gave, a public shiur, which was about a totally different topic. The topic of the shiur happens to have been gerus, conversions. And that shiur he made a very famous statement. All this, of course, I have the tape in my car. It's on tape and CDs, and it was even transcribed. He says that a convert who doesn't actually fulfill the mitzvahs, and his word was absurd, he threw a whole bunch of expressions. That shiur is all about conversion. But it's less well known that it's about conversion, because the most important part of the shiur for the world is his introduction. And his introduction, he said, this is not the topic, but I have to unburden myself. And he goes into a whole diatribe, and a certain rabbi said, this no longer applies. And he says this will apply, as he put it there, Kimei Hashamayim Al Haaretz. As long as the heavens will be on top of the earth, that's how long this will apply. He says, an existential idea, it's something which can never change. I want to make my own compromise, if I may. That the first rabbi was correct. That one aspect of it is subject to change. But it's true that in time of the Talmud, there was this idea of a financial ability, for the man could make a living and the woman could not, and that detail can change. But my Rebbe is saying that even beyond that fact, that financial fact, there's the existential makeup of a woman, which is simply different than that of a man. And the Rav felt this is built into nature and simply cannot change. And the Rav was very strong. He said, this rabbi wants to tell me that these things change. The chazokos means that the assumptions that the rabbis have about these issues change. I might as well take the Gemara in Yevamos and the Gemara in Gittin and put it into the fire and just stop saying Shir on two Masechtos because it doesn't apply anymore. This is not like Rav Soloveitchik. Those who knew the Rav know this is not like him. This is not at all his style to talk this way. He was a very calm person. He didn't get so upset usually about certain things. But he really, really hit the roof about this. And it's interesting also know the history of the yeshiva. It had an impact. This is, I think, 1973, I think is when the shiur was given. A few years later, this was relevant to this, what we'll call the succession, but we're not going to go there right now. Yes?
Did he have any proofs other than that he said that this made a statement?
No.
All right, so let's say other people come up and say, let's do some sociological research. Let's take polls of women today. As a matter of fact, you don't even have to do it. There's a poll that, forget about a poll, you could see the data of divorces, okay? People today, in secular society, a man can divorce a wife, and a wife can divorce a man, right? Check out how many women divorce their men every single day. It's probably 50%.
I guess it's probably more.
Maybe more. Okay, so now, with data like that, the data is saying that given their free choice, women do want to get rid of the husbands they don't like rather than be married.
100%. Okay. They would want to find a new husband that they will like.
But they're not guaranteed to find a new husband. They're first throwing out the baby, okay?
Because unfortunately, let's be realistic. Unfortunately, Aval Hashem Manachnu, as men, the group of men in the world in terms of marriage who misbehave, I'm sorry to use that expression, who misbehave in many different ways, unfortunately, is greater than that same percentage with respect to women in all different ways of misbehavior, whether it be cheating, you know what I mean by cheating, whether it be beating, I'm like a poet, cheating, beating, I better stop here because I don't want to go on here, I don't want to demean the entire male population, but in those two, unfortunately, men are...
You think it's greater than it was before? I
didn't say it's greater than it was before. I
think
it was greater than it was before. They always, maybe less than it was before. That's why I conceded. I'm a liberal. I conceded to the first rabbi in saying that there were many women who knew that their husbands cheated and their husband beat it, but they couldn't budge because of the financial considerations. They could were stuck.
But now they could.
Now they could. But the first rabbi said in a broad statement. As a result, this whole Kanta of the Gemara, Tav Lemesev, no longer exists. But I believe that my rabbi took umbrage to that.
But this statement is a sociological statement. It's a statement that says that this is part of a woman's, makeup, and she can't change it. You could show, with the proof either way.
You certainly haven't disproved what my rabbi said. Maybe someone could try to disprove it.
All right, I don't want to try to disprove
okay.
it.
Okay.
But if somebody does disprove it...
We'll worry about it then, like many other things we have to worry about when things that the sociological data or scientific data doesn't add up to what we see. I want to tell you another thing.
I think we're talking about generalization.
Of course.
There are certainly, it's not that all men are disproved.
No, whatever we say today, I should open my mouth carefully and say, anything we say today is a generalization. Because obviously there are men who have different... features and women of different people. We're talking about in generalities. I want to say one other thing about this issue. There's a beautiful book, which I did not read because I can't find it. Someone can bring it together. Very much like to read it. It's called The Moon's Lost Light. Anyone in this room ever read it? Ever see it? I'm sorry. I feel so bad about this. Okay. How do I even know about it? I only know about it because Hagoyen Rav Meir Twersky Shlita, our neighbor, wrote a review about it in Jewish Action. Okay, slowly. It's written by an author who with a pseudonym. We don't know I don't know the name of the real author, and with approbations by great rabbis in the Holy Land. And her main thesis seems to be against what my rabbi said, that things can change. And her main source is no less than the Vilna Gaon. Yeah, the Vilna Gaon. How so? Because the Gemara tells us in the Masechta Erevin that Chava, the first woman, received 10 curses because of her original sin. 10 curses. And the Vilna Gaon is quoted as saying that these curses are going to gradually lift at the end of time, just as man's curses, all the curses are going to start gradually lifting towards the end of time. For example, the fact that men had to work so hard, back-breaking work on the farm, that's lifted a little bit. Or for example, the terrible pains of childbirth. These days, they give them shots. So some of these pains are lifted. forgive me for saying it now because it's a little bit, but it's, I think it's the same thing. One of the ten, the woman has is her menstrual period. Now I get the shadows all the time. My most common shadow I get now these days is the young women. They've done away with that. They're almost done away with it. The problem is almost. I get all the almost. They get done away with it. Almost did away with it, but they have. So it's possible that these things can lift, and it's therefore one could argue that Tavla Meis was one of the, in effect one of those curses. It could also start lifting. As a matter of fact, Rabbi Tversky Shalita, in his response to this author, says, you know, my grandfather disagrees on this point. Thinks things can change. Kimei Shemayim Al Aretz. I'm trying to make a compromise. It can change partially. I'm willing to concede, but it cannot be obliterated totally. That's as far as I want to go. I'm sure I'm not making anybody happy. The purists and my Rebbe's Hasidim will say I'm being disloyal to him, and the modernists say I'm being antiquated. But that's where I usually seem to be, in the middle of all these things. So I'm used to it. That's fine. But that's what I think, that we cannot just obliterate completely, but it does have something to be said for all generations. For those who wish to see what my Rebbe said, I have a transcript in my house. I also have the tape in my car. It's an introduction to his shiur about conversions. You can get it online and on one of these, whatever. I'm looking at Torah Web. It's something or other. I don't know exactly. You'll ask the people who know. It's worth listening to or worth reading. Very, very important. English. Absolutely in English. Totally in English. Okay. Fine. So, let's continue back where we are. A marital relationship is important for a man, but to a woman it is essential. That's an interesting choose. This man knows English, Rabbi Feldman. He knows English very well. Important and essential. If you ask me, it's almost the same thing. Important and essential. Obviously, you make a distinction. See, important means it's important. Essential means it's like it's more important. However you want to say it. It's essential. Marriage, more than anything else, satisfies her core need to be admired and loved. Outside of marriage, she feels, quote, like a widow. It is no wonder that, as it can be commonly seen, women suffer more deeply following a divorce than men. I'm not sure you can do a survey about that. Loneliness apparently affects them more than men. This is what my Rebbe said. This is what he says. I'm not sure what the sociologists say, what the therapists say. I don't know. I just don't know. I don't claim to have any knowledge of the modern sociological or psychological data. All I know is that this rabbi says it. Can be commonly seen. Just look around. He says. I don't know. I'm not willing even to say that much based on my looking around. What I'm just quoting. I'm quoting is what the Rabbi Feldman says and my Rebbe said, and I assume it's true. And if there's data to the contrary, I'd love to see it. We'll try to reconcile the two. Okay, let's continue. Beginning relatively early in childhood, females are more concerned about their appearance than males. Well, that's certainly true. That, I think no one disagrees with that. Am I right? I saw that in my house. Little girls, for example, care more about their clothing, even their handwriting, than do little boys. Girls are toilet trained earlier than boys. He quotes a source. I'll tell you this, since I have the source, which you don't have. He footnotes it. Let's see. Warren and Bolter, Bedwetting, Origins and Treatments, Pergamon Press, 1975. I'm just telling you. Okay. And then he says, women's greater dependency on others has also been scientifically documented as an Encyclopedia Britannica, volume 27, page 319b. You have to figure out what year Britannica this is. It's 20 years old. But look, he's not afraid to quote, you know, non-Jewish sources to prove the points that he's trying to make. Okay, maybe. Again, if they don't agree, I want to deal with it. I don't hide from
source about it, so that's not.
Okay. Yep. If you call country sources, I'm happy to hear about it. And I'm happy to deal with it.
I'm not trying to argue either way. Right. I'm just saying that's why I asked if Rabbi Soloveitchik had a proof. That would have been interesting because if the facts on the ground prove to be different, do we have to listen to them, or do we say like other things? It doesn't matter what the fact on the ground proved to be. This is what the Gemara said and the story.
I have been quoted in the past that I am very concerned with the facts. Maybe more concerned with facts than other rabbis who say, forget the facts, the Gemara said so. That's never been my way. I don't think it was my Rebbe's way either. I think my Rebbe also felt that the facts have to fall into line. If the facts are different, we'll deal with it. He, in his lifetime, felt the facts were that way. Obviously, this rabbi, living a little bit later, feels the same way. If there's data to the country, do me a favor. I'm deputizing everybody in the room. Bring me the data. I want to see it. I'm happy to see it. Let's see. Let's work on it. I try not to run away from facts. That was my training. Okay? I don't want to go into this whole discussion over here that they're concerned about their men, that there's the women's fashion industry. Whee! you know, this is a whole story. Fine. But what's fascinating over here is in the next page, 48, men are also interested in how they look, but it's such a different idea. Something fascinating. He says, women want clothing to be pleasing and eye-catching, and men don't say, please look at me, but rather to gain respect, prestige, or a certain image, dignified, young, rich, not to attract attention. Quotes of Yochanan in Bava Kamma, money mechabdusa, are the honorers. It's Bava Kamma, we quote it from Shabbos Kuf Yud Gimel, but I know it from Bava Kamma, that it honors you, but for women they're quote-unquote attractors. And for this reason, he quotes a Gemara, in Masechta Pesachim, Kuftes, that a husband is obligated to buy for his wife every Yom Tov begodim tzivonim, colored clothing. Why colored clothing? What was this colored clothing? Why can't it be? It could be white clothing.
I know.
Huh?
I'm black today.
Yeah, it's against the Gemara.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's changed.
What's changed?
You try to wear a red dress at a Pasusha wedding, you'll be kicked out.
So leave out red. Because red has a somewhat of a base in the Gemara. You will not find blue, you will not find brown, you'll not find gray. Everything's black. It's against the Gemara. What do these people do? They're against these frum people against the Gemara. The Gemara says begotten Sivonim. Colored garments. Oh come on. That's really not. You know, we know there's black and white and there's color. But it's hard for me to assume that color is black. I really don't. I'm not opposed to someone wearing black. But only black? Black for Afsio? Nothing else but black? Where'd that come from?
English.
Yeah, exactly. People have suggested that certain individuals belong to a, quote, cult. Because they only wear black. I just don't understand. This is not. I grew up with Hasidim, with Yeshivish. They didn't always, they wore all colors. They didn't wear red. They didn't wear red. What, men? There's no obligation for a woman to buy her husband begodim tzivonim for Yom. Doesn't exist. We don't find anything about begodim tzivonim.
What?
I understand that. Again.
I saw a questionnaire, you know, that people use for Shatanis purposes, and one of the questions was, does he ever wear blue pants instead of black?
There's an expression now in the yeshiva, are you a black and white person or not? That's how it goes. Black and white means a black pants and a white shirt. And in our yeshiva, some boys are black and white, and some boys, because we have a more modern yeshiva, are not black and white, which means they'll go with striped shirts, they'll go with blue pants. I find nothing wrong with it myself. But I find nothing wrong with it. But I wear blue suits, and I'm still wearing white shirts, but I do wear blue suits and then gray suits, and I don't wear red suits, but it's hard to find them. But I don't believe that men have to wear black. But I have no problem with men who want to wear only black. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. Because that's, you know, that's a certain tradition that they had. Fine. Gray hat, it's hard to find to buy anyway. But a woman should wear only black? That's against the Gemara. That's against the Gemara. The Gemara says, begodim tzivonim. I don't like to go against the Gemara. I just don't like it. Now I'm going to give you an answer they're going to give me. I'm predicting. If I go over to a Rav, this is the answer they're going to give me. I'm making a prediction. And maybe if some of you could go over to your Hasidic, or I think it's even Yeshivish now, not only Hasidic. Go over any Hasidish, Yeshivish, and they tell you, why are you wearing only black at the Gemara since the beginning of the song? I'm predicting an answer they're going to tell you. Listen, I'm going to give you, the Gemara also, I'm going to predict yourself. They're going to tell you like this. Of course in the Gemara's time, they wore blue and green and pink and orange, whatever color, brown, gray. You know why? Because they stayed home. They followed the Rambam. left the house once a month. So for the husbands, they had to wear all kinds of beautiful clothes. But nowadays, quote, Bavanosenu Harabim, due to our many sins, the women have to leave the house. That's how they're only black. That's what they're going to answer you. I'm thinking on my feet what the answer they're going to give you. Do me a favor. Somebody ask and find if let me know next time if I'm right. Am I right or not? This is going to be the answer they're going
to
give you.
What do you answer back to them?
That's a good question. I'll answer like this. That if Bavonosenu Harabin, do our many sins, women have to leave the house, right? So that means that things are different now than they were then. And therefore, I believe strongly that a woman who was entrusted, is being entrusted to leave the house, could be entrusted to leave the house in a blue dress. And she doesn't. She's so traditional. She's so frum. Then she shouldn't leave the house at all. But she's if she can leave the house, she can wear a blue dress too.
They'll say it's not the woman; it's the man who's going to see the woman. I'm not saying it's a problem on the woman per se. And no, that's what they'll say.
Okay, maybe they'll respond that way. Well, you know, if men are so bad, then the woman shouldn't leave the house. Okay. There are those who say women shouldn't leave the house. They try to. I mean, I told you that there was a case of Rabbi Yosef who yelled at the Kerlnik, who tried to impose a once a month or twice at most policy on his wife. The world has changed.
How did she go to work?
What?
How did she go to work?
She wasn't.
She so who worked?
Nobody.
Nobody.
The Shver pays the money. I don't know what happened to that. But Rabbi Yashiv was very critical, as I mentioned to you in the story, which was told to you, which I actually printed somewhere. Let's go a little bit further. Simple white garments are not enough to make a woman's heart glad. It is necessary to supply her with colored clothing, i.e., clothing which makes her attractive to her husband. We're not going to say makes her attractive to the outside man, which is not appropriate. But again, since in our world, women are in fact leaving the house, and we don't find that they change their clothes when they walk into the house. And they walk out with black. And then they come, they go into the closet, and they change right away into blue, or things of this nature. So we are liberal and allow them to walk the streets with blue clothing as well. Again, the not to argue. We already provide the arguments for those who think to the contrary. And we love all Jews. We're not trying to be critical of anybody. But the simple interpretation is that it's permissible for women to wear clothes, especially on the holidays. And holidays was a time, if anything, that most people did go out. In other words, in holidays, even in places where women did not necessarily go out on holidays, just the nature of things is that they went out, and they went out in their colored garments. Yes, it's true. The Rambam says you have to have what they call a vice patrol. The Rambam says you have to appoint cops to go into the bushes to prevent men and women from sinning. The Rambam says so. So there was that's correct. The Yetzer Hara is not new, right? That boys and girls men and women would do things which are wrong. It's not a new thing, but it's not stopped the rabbis from telling the husband to buy his wife a colored garment. Yes.
I'm just thinking the Gemara in Shabbos talks about women going out on, you know, like for carrying purposes with their jewelry and other things and other accoutrements, which means that the Gemara did assume that they went out at least every week on Shabbos.
There you go. Okay. There you go. Okay, let us go a little bit further. So it's important to understand there's a total difference in approach. Now, a husband should go to great lengths to make sure that his wife feels loved and cared for. Now, I heard a story today, which I'm going to say right away. Today, a certain husband, and it's mind-boggling. I'm not telling you any of us should try to keep the standard. I think it's probably too high for most regular people. But a certain husband never left his house, if I have the story correct, without telling his wife, never left the house. Now, people leave the house in the morning, without telling her, I love you and I'll always love you. Never left the house without saying that. Wow. That's a high level. I don't know of anybody who is in that madrega. But even we take down a few steps, still, it's important that a husband explains to his wife how much he loves her. Nothing shocks the new wife more than the suspicion that her husband may not love her as much as she had hoped. We said before, it's like akin to spilling her blood. Okay? This should never happen in the home of a Jewish man committed to doing chesed to every Jew, especially the wife whose happiness he has specifically undertaken to enhance in marriage. I want to tell you something very important, which is not found over here. Maybe it's found elsewhere in the book, I don't know. The Sefer Charedim. The Sefer Charedim was one of the great, we'll call it Musa Svarim, of hundreds of years ago. And he makes the following statement, which is, it is quoted for sure in by Rabbi Shlomo Valba in his pamphlet for new husbands. And as we mentioned in our previous shiur, we're all new husbands, we should all be trying to do better. He says a Charedim, that if a person, no matter how many good deeds he does, I repeat again, no matter how many good deeds he does acts of kindness and of charity and of communal service, the works, if he treats his wife shabbily, all of the good deeds that he does will not count for anything at the day of ultimate judgment. Won't count. Now, I've explained to my students, this is at first glance a very unfair statement. It's exceedingly unfair. When he goes up for his eternal judgment, we should say like this, all your good deeds on one side, and you treat your wife poorly on the other side. Why is it that if he treats his wife poorly, all those good deeds don't count for anything? It's so hard to understand. I think I know the answer. There have been cases in which I've discovered later, to my chagrin, I always wondered why a particular individual, A, B, or C, was so involved in communal affairs. He was always running to meetings and always, you know, volunteering for committees and all kinds of communal and charitable work, even including learning all kinds of hours, and I was just amazed at what he was actually doing. Until I found out that his marriage was terrible. In other words, he wasn't, you know, it wasn't self-sacrifice on his part to leave the house to attend the A shiur, B meeting, C run this and that. It was an escape. And if a person is doing all these good deeds as an escape, why does he deserve credit for them? He's not doing it because he realizes it's the right thing. It's an escape. So if the man treats his wife poorly, that means his marriage is no good, and he just doesn't want to be anywhere near his wife, and he walks out all the time to the shiur or to the communal work, etc., etc., he deserves credit for that. He's doing it to get away from somebody whom he treats terribly. A person who treats his wife wonderfully, and he says, I love you, whenever he walks out of the house, and he means it. I'm not just going to, from now on, you'll say, ooh, you have to really mean it. And he, despite that fact, he'll take leave of his wife either to go to a shiur or to take care of a communal function, etc., etc. That man deserves credit for what he's doing. That's sacrificial in nature. I think that's the correct interpretation. What does that mean? There are women who drive their husbands crazy. Absolutely. There's no doubt it exists. I know someone. Exactly. I know someone. I'm not going to, of course, mention the name. He was never home. He was always learning. What's unbelievable? And I answered later, why? His wife was a little bit, and then she drove him crazy. So he wanted to be shalom with his wife. So he minimized the opportunities to be home. So he was always in the basement just learning. He was going late hours. I'm completely aware that it goes in two ways. But I'm focusing now, and this is a book intended for men, and I'm happy that the women brought it up, because if a man would bring it up, we'd be in trouble. So thank you, Shishi, for bringing it up. I appreciate that. Yes?
What if a man is by nature a stingy person? He doesn't spend money for anything on himself or anybody. And that's the way he treats his wife also, but not because, you know, it's his name. He comes up to Shemayim and says, look, that's the way I live. That's the way I treat myself. Why should I treat her better than
Very me? Good question. The answer why you should look in the Rambam. Well, the Rambam and the Gemara. It says, Mechabda Yoser Migufo. For yourself, you should be stingy. Keep the same suit for 10 years. That's no problem. If your wife had to bring a buyer a new dress, color dress, every Yom Tov at least. So there's no contradiction. It's not an excuse how you treat yourself. Okay, let's go a little bit further. A wise husband can therefore never afford to stop demonstrating that he cares for his wife. And he is not likely to if he makes a conscious effort to pay serious attention to the various favors and benefits he receives from her. It's unbelievable. I'm talking about an average husband owes to his average wife. I'm not discussing the exceptional, wonderful, an average case. She does so many things for him. I mean, too many to enumerate. What a wife does for her husband. You know, the Gemara is a great story. It's a sad story, but it's a great story. The story is told of one of the great Amoraim, whose wife was I guess you might call it a shrew these days. Whatever he wanted, she did the reverse. If he asks for barley soup, she made bean soup. If he asks for bean soup, she made barley soup. Always the reverse. So the children saw what's going on. So they wanted the father to get what he wanted, so they switched. The father asked for bean soup, so they said, "Mommy, daddy wants barley soup." So she made bean soup. So the husband was flabbergasted. What's going on over here? She actually cooked what he asked for. So he asked his children. He said, "Oh yeah, but we flipped it because we saw what's going on." He says, "Well, you had no right to flip it." He said, "But how do you survive this way?" He says, "No, the famous expression, Dayenu shemegadlos esbonenu umatzilos osonu min hachet. We should be satisfied that our wives bring up our children and they save us from sin." That's a mind-boggling statement. Here's the one, everything he says, she does the reverse. And even though, despite that fact, he wants to get to love her and cherish her. How much more so we'll call the average wife. I'm not saying the exceptional wife. The average wife, that if he asks for bean soup, she'll make him bean soup. Huh? So how much more so must he cherish her and love her and appreciate her for everything that she does for him? It's simple as all that. The problem is we sometimes take the people closest to us for granted. You'll say thank you to the person in the checkout counter. No, I'm serious. You'll say thank you to somebody, a doorman, and not to your own wife. My wife. She's me. She's part of me. No. No, absolutely not. You know, sometimes, this is an incredible story, there are individuals who will not cherish their spouses and somehow will say things. Even I was reminded about the checkout counter. I have a story about this, which is written in one of these books. This is the other way around. Since Shushi opened the door for me, I'm allowed to take a few steps through. This is the following story. They say a woman is with her husband at a checkout counter and in a supermarket. And the husband bumbles, drops something, I don't know what. So she makes a comment to the checkout lady who she never met before in life. And I was like, my husband, he's always dropping things. He's always a klutz. Huh? What is this? Why are you siding with the checkout counter lady against your own husband? Think about that. Think about it. But it happens. It happens. Chalila can happen the other direction, which is much worse. People don't recognize the critical nature of always supporting a spouse. I tell my Talmidim, your spouse is always right. Not true, of course, but with respect to the rest of the world, your spouse is always right. Anybody comes to you and criticizes a spouse, absolutely dead. No quarter. No quarter. I've been criticized many times by many people. Okay, I take it, I hear it. You cannot criticize my spouse to me. It's not acceptable. Not acceptable. You're in the doghouse. Can't get out. Can't. It's impossible. Can't do it. Impossible. And everyone has to realize that you have to form one unit with a spouse. I don't want to use the word against all comers, but that's what it really boils down to. And this is particularly true if chalila v'chas is a critique from the in-laws. This happens sometimes. In-laws who are not so smart will go to their child and criticize his or her spouse. And I get these shaylos on a regular basis from my talmidim. That's why I know what happens. I say to them, time after time, you have to tell your father or mother, daddy, mommy, I love you very much. The rabbi said, blame it on me, the rabbi said that my spouse is always right, and I'll take care of it. Whatever you're saying, I'll take care of it with her. I cannot admit to you that any faults you're pointing out are correct, and therefore really it's not productive for us to continue these conversations. Finished. That's my position. Maybe it's a little bit extreme. That's my position. I feel very strongly this way. Very strongly. And this is how a wife or a husband has confidence that he or she will be supported by the spouse, come what may. Come what may. And no one else on the outside, either in a silly context. Do you know what goes on sometimes? That's unbelievable. They have these young couples, I'm sorry to just use the expression, isn't it? Most people are past that stage. But young couples, is to sit around, and I was once privy to this, I was once invited to speak or something, it's crazy. Sit around the couch in the living room, you know, with four or five young couples, and then with this one-upsmanship, everyone's digging everybody else, and including that one spouse is digging another. You know? And it's terrible. I find it mind-boggling. Just, you know, banter, silliness. But Chas v'Shalom, a husband or wife who hears the spouse, in effect, bashing them in this context of everyone else roasting everybody else around the living room couch or around the dining room table, it's a disaster. Don't tell me it's a joke. No, this is not a joking matter. It's not a joking matter. A couple, certainly in the presence of anybody else, have to always be that way. And I want to make another cautionary remark. Sometimes couples fight, if I'm using that expression, in the presence of their own children in the house. A disaster. If couples have a disagreement, and we're going to get that I would like to get to it today. They have a disagreement, they have to resolve it, but not in anybody else's presence. Unless, and I say this very strongly, unless they find there's a problem in their marriage, there's nothing wrong to that, it exists. It exists. And if they come to me and I view the problem as being something serious, my first response is, you have to go to a professional. I'm not a professional. I mean, I've dealt with many couples. There are people to go to. And I'm proud of the fact that I've saved marriages by sending the couple to a professional. I doubt I could have done it myself. But I'm very proud of that fact. When I see this couple together, every time I think about it, the marriage was on the rocks, and I made a proper referral. And that saved their lives. Saved their lives. Rav Pam, I think I mentioned it once before, Rav Pam asked Dr. Wickler, who put out a book called Bias Nemen V'Yisrael, one thing please put in the book. If there's a problem, the couple has a problem, go to the rabbi, who should refer to a therapist. Don't go to the parents. The only can make matters worse. They can't see it in a balanced way. Because they're tzaddik. That's written in the book. As by Rav Pam's behest. I feel very strongly this way. They shouldn't be firing the presence of their children. It's no good. It's no good. The children get there. You know, it hurts them. It creates scar tissue. It's something very, very, very bad. Let me go a little bit further. But showing simple gratitude is not enough. It is necessary to shower her with praise for this. Because a wife needs to feel she is beloved. Her husband should leave no room for doubt. Compliments and praise are the elemental way of creating this consciousness. It is a fascinating story. This is a great story. One of my teachers carried this principle to what some might call extremes. Shortly after his marriage, his wife served him burnt potatoes for supper. Instead of complaining, he told her, "Oh, what a wonderful dish you've made tonight." His wife was so pleased that she made him the same dish many suppers afterwards, each of which he duly complimented, although it was becoming more and more difficult for him to eat the burnt potatoes. When my teacher saw that there was no other way out of the dilemma he had created for himself, he finally told her, "You know, my dear wife, let's try something new. One can get tired of anything." I don't think I told you the story about Rabbi Lezer Levine. I don't think I told you the story. No, did I say it? No one remembers it. Probably didn't. I heard the story from someone who heard it from a family member. Rabbi Lezer Levine was a rabbi of Detroit for many years. He was for many, many, many years. He was married for decades upon decades. His wife passed away. And one of his daughters was taking care of him. Many illustrious family members. And as always, she made him egg for breakfast. Well, that's what the wife always made her husband for 50 years, eggs for breakfast. So when she knew that, he told his daughter, whatever her name was, do me a favor, don't make me eggs for breakfast. Nothing to do with cholesterol. Cholesterol would have been okay, but this story is unbelievable. Nothing to do with that. This is the story. Rabbi Eliezer Levine was a young man, an unmarried man in Europe. They used to eat what they used to call teg. Teg meant that there was no dining room, like in all the yeshivas today. They'd go, you know, to various people who were nice, who'd give them some food. They agreed to them, you know, the rabbi made an appeal. Okay, so one woman said, I'll take care of this person. Every day I'll give him something for breakfast. But there are different ways of giving things for breakfast. You know, you can invite him to your house and schmooze with him. That's the highest level of Achnasa Sarachim. You can give him the, you know, you don't want to leave your house. You can open the door, give him the food with a smile. That's the next best. This woman was not so happy. Maybe her husband made the commitment she didn't really want in the first. Whatever it was, whenever he would come to the door, she would open it like this much and gave him an egg and with a frown. Here, Nadia, take this. This is the extra room. Ever since then, he had no choice but to eat it because he didn't know what he'd starve. He hated eggs because it always reminded him of the indignity of his youth. Okay. Got married. His wife was used to baking eggs. So she had eggs for 50 years. Now that his wife passed away, his daughter, says, I don't want eggs. So he said, Daddy, so why didn't you tell Mommy for all these 50 years? I didn't have the heart to tell her. He suffered for 50 years with eggs for breakfast, which always reminded him of the indignity of his youth, rather than tell his wife to change the menu. That's extremes. That's extremes. Extremes. And even the teacher who carried to an extreme corrected it after a while with the burnt potatoes. I'm not telling you Emma should do this. I wouldn't do it. I'm with you. Whatever it may be, these are extremes. These are not, I'm just giving you to the extent that some people went. I'm not saying you should.
And you read these stories, like, this is so admirable. So it's like, masochism is like, you know,
like,
let's be a masochist.
I'm not a masochist. I'm only using it as an what he calls extremes of individuals who didn't want to upset a wife. Now, I agree. No one in this room, I don't think, is on that level. We shouldn't try to be on that level. If you're not on that level, you shouldn't be who you are not. I'm just giving you an example of extremes. Now, I want to continue. I'm almost running out of time to talk about the most important part of today's shiur. The most important part of today's shiur, which is criticism. Criticism. Number one, any criticism and anger is a disaster. Disaster. A total disaster. After we finish a Blin Neder, next week, I'll be in Eretz Yisrael. In 2 weeks, I want to give the final installment on the what we call more on the female nature. Then I want to talk about what I call parent-children relationships. We spoke about children-parents. Keep it up. We never spoke about parenting. I want to talk about that, Mitzvashem, after the next year. Okay? Believe that. So there also, any criticism given in anger usually is ineffective, and it can cause a real, real, real disaster. Disaster. He gives it on the next page, which you don't have. He had a husband had serious domestic difficulties. So he said, why? He says, like this. He's proud that conversation was one of the strong points of his marriage. Whenever they sat down to dinner, they didn't waste their time with idle chatter. He made sure to talk about the things he thought she had done wrong during the day. Idle chatter would be 100 times better. I'm a sugar, crazy guy. Now.
I'm thinking about one marital fight that I could think of that's in the Torah. It's documented in the Torah.
Yes.
Between Yaakov and Rachel.
Right. And do you know what the Chazal say about that? Chazal say that Yaakov told Rachel, when Rachel said, Hobo libonim, v'yim ayin mesa anochi, so what did he say? Hasachas Elokim, anochi hashamana v'mech pribotan. What did Chazal say in the Medrash on that very pasuk? Kach mishivin ala ma'ukos? That's how you speak to individuals who are, he was punished for that. Seriously punished, Chazal say. It's a Medrash on that very pasuk. I have to tell you that when I went to visit the Pua Institute, usually I go there when I'm in Eretz. Maybe I have a chance to go this week, you know, coming week or next week. Rav Burstein, Shlita, Rav Menachem Burstein is the head of this Pua Institute. People come there and they, you know, they have so many infertility problems, and they come and they hack a chinik and they talk all kinds of silly things, and he's something's tempting after a while to, you know, enough of this already. He has on his desk, he showed it to me, on his desk he has those words. These are people who are, unfortunately, have problems. No matter what they say, whether it's right, whether it's wrong, you're not permitted to respond that way. And Yaakov was criticized by the Chazal for it. And as you said, not everything that our patriarchs do is automatically right. If the Chazal in the Medrash, I'm not talking about these modern Midrash, the new Midrash is nuts, but the classical Midrash is willing to say that our forefathers or foremothers made mistakes. And this is considered a terrible mistake by Yaakov, which he was severely punished. There it is. So Chazal said so. We have no, I don't think we have license to say that, but Chazal has license to say that. So they said it in the Medrash. We have to be so careful. So careful. Chazal tells us in a different context. But especially I'm talking now for men speaking to wives. How do you speak to a woman? You speak to men in a harsh tone. But to a woman in a soft tone, Amira Raka, soft tone. That's the only thing that could ever possibly work. Nothing else can work. One word that should be avoided in all criticisms, the word is always. Why do you always do this? Why do you always? What always? Someone made a mistake once, so focus on the once. We were always. I want to say another thing. This is not in this book, but it's in Rav Valba's book. When a spouse will be critical of another, they'll bring back issues from 25 years ago, without exaggeration. 25 years ago. That's how long you're married. You did this, and 20 years you did this, and 40 years you did this. It's like a vion pokti pokarti by the ego. It says, whenever this, once we start, what's that going to do for the marriage? That's no good. It's absolutely no good. Now, if there's a problem, you can sit down and talk about it nicely. It's so important that any such thing be done nicely. The truth is, people have come to me in the past, certainly my wife is this, and I said, you know, let it go. Let it go. The man is right. What the woman does is wrong. So what? Overlook her fault. I mentioned in the last year, but one of the most important things of the first week of Sheva Brachos is overlooking the faults of a spouse. That's why we don't see his negoyim. Why only the first week? The whole marriage. It's overlook the faults of a spouse. You also have faults. Look in the mirror. Who do you think you are anyway? Overlook the faults. So, you know, maybe in your heart there may be certain faults. But in your mind, there are no faults. The woman is doing so much for you. You owe everything to her. And if there's something which is not done in a perfect fashion, so what? The best criticism in my mind is no criticism. I'm giving you my opinion. I know those don't agree with me. That's my opinion. No criticism. That's all. No one's perfect. If I'm not perfect, so he or she is not perfect, it's a perfect shidduch. The only perfect thing is the shidduch itself. Right, an imperfect person with another imperfect person makes a perfect shidduch.
Probably are times when you have to say something like, "Is this still Hashem or Aveva or something?"
Oh, come on!
Do this on Shabbos. I mean, on their times.
No, you have to say no. You have to be very careful.
I didn't say you have to be
that careful. Yeah. The Gemara tells us. We can spend a time about the Friday afternoon syndrome. The Gemara talks about the Friday afternoon syndrome when everyone's the nerves and they're afraid. That's the worst time to get angry. And you have to be very calm, very calm, and not get upset. You know, the Chafetz Chaim, I think, writes one of his svarim, if the wife is not lighting the candles on time, don't scream and yell at her, just go light the candles yourself and walk out the door. That's all. Yeah. if it's a very last minute, that's it. Go to shul. But to scream at your wife that she's a chalal shal, you can't do that. Can't. You have to understand that not only is Erev Shabbos, what about Shabbos itself? Terrible. Lo savaru eish b'chol moshvosecha b'yom haShabbos. You should not burn a fire on Shabbos. The Bali Musaf explained it means the fire of Machlekes. The story is told of the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim was once a surprise guest in somebody's house. Someone found the Chafetz Chaim in shul, invited him home to go to Lador. He came home. Things were not exactly the way he would have liked it to be. That's not his wife's fault. She didn't know the Chafetz Chaim was coming. So when he walked to the house, and he was so upset the way the house looked, and the Gadol, he gave her a few harsh words. What did she do? She ran into a room, closed the door, and started to cry. She wouldn't come out. Stay waiting for 10 minutes, for 20 minutes. Father, the Baal Bosad Rebbe, my husband, my wife's not coming out. We have to, let's make Kiddush. I'm not making Kiddush. You're not allowed to make Kiddush. Why am I making Kiddush? Why do we cover the chalas, says Chafetz Chaim? Why do we cover the chalas when we make Kiddush? So one of the reasons given is that the chalas shouldn't be embarrassed. She'll hear a hapaz boshto. Because normally, we make a bracha on wheat products before grape products. Chita, sara, gefen. And now I make a bracha on a grape product before a wheat product. So we shouldn't be embarrassed, we cover it up. Right? Challah is an inanimate object. Not really embarrassed. You expect me to make Kiddush when your wife is embarrassed? No way. You go into that room, whatever is coming to you, you'll take. Your wife come out smiling, don't make Kiddush, not before. We have to learn lessons from our Gedolim. These are critical, critical, critical lessons. It's so, so important. We're not permitted to conduct ourselves in an inappropriate fashion. Much more to be said about these topics. Much, much more. But our time is up. Again, to repeat, next week, no shir. In 2 weeks, more on the female nature. I want to talk about the home and other Noshim dat on kalos, a very famous expression of what that means. That'll be Mr. Shem in 2 weeks. Okay, good vach.